Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we get started, I do want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, the presenting sponsor of RAISE, the event fundraising conference. OneCause invites you to join them at RAISE, being held this year in Washington, D.C. on September 14th and 15th. RAISE brings together hundreds of fundraising professionals, industry experts, and nonprofit speakers to share insights and network with others innovating in the world of fundraising. To join the community of fearless fundraisers attending RAISE and to learn more about the conference, please visit www.onecause.com/responsive50. That's www.onecause.com/responsive50. Hi, podcast listeners. Welcome to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Bev Browning. Bev, would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners before we get started?
Hi, everyone. Thank you for listening to this podcast. I'm excited to be here, and I hope I can share some information that is both factual, provocative as far as thinking forward, and can help some of you in your efforts along the way related to grant writing and a lot of other things that come in with fundraising.
Yeah, so Bev, you've been around, how long have you been in fundraising?
Oh my goodness, 44 years this month.
Yeah, so when I talk to people who've been in fundraising for three or four decades like yourself, one of the things that I like to sort of get your thoughts on first is you have, because I've been in almost two and a half decades, so one of the things that you have seen over the process of your career, you have seen fundraising sort of mature. You have sort of seen it come of age. How is it different today than what it was, say, when you started or during that first decade?
Well, when I started, my title was project specialist, and I just thought that the only job was to do proposal writing or grant writing for a large school district, intermediate school district with 28, maybe 38 LEAs. And I basically worked on their federal and state and foundation grant applications and helped create the grants development office. What I didn't realize is that I was going to be drawn into fundraising because I've never really called myself a true fundraiser. But here's what I can tell you, the difference between then and now. Then the checks weren't as frequent when they came from philanthropists or people with money who weren't well known in the philanthropy community.
Yeah.
They weren't nearly as large as they are now. There were no $1 million checks. But back at that time, if you took a look at median income, certainly a check for $100,000 was considered substantial. But it took 2 years to get that check from the person, and it was on their deathbed. Today, I think we have all these technology resources where we can source out people, identify their net worth, determine who they're supporting, what board they sit on, and how we approach them as many, many nonprofits swarm upon the same group of philanthropists in a region or community to go after money. I don't think it takes as long to get the check because there are so many capital campaigns going on at the same time. But I think the effort is quicker. Whether it's better or not, I'm not sure. I think if I worked as a development director and told my executive director that, yes, I can get a check, but it's going to take 2 years, I don't think that would be a priority for the organization that I worked for. I think, in fact, that would probably be let go.
So was that time horizon? That's an interesting observation. I don't think I've ever heard anyone make that observation, but I'm interested to sort of sit on that for a moment. Would you say it was more organic, or was there more sincerity and less mechanics?
Definitely more sincerity when you go to someone's house that lives in a gated estate,
yeah,
that has very few visitors, that once owned a chain of major grocery stores in the Michigan area, yeah, with their name on it, and now there are no living heirs or sisters or brothers or nieces or nephews or anyone. And other than the servants, this person is extremely reclusive, rarely seen out in public. Just the effort to get through those gates and to sit down and start to begin, and it wasn't even a fundraising dialogue. He was lonely. We talked about his wife, her death, how much he missed her, how he had frozen her cookies, and they were already in the freezer for 10 years, and he still has one when special events occur, like their anniversary, her birthday, his birthday. And it took him all of 4 months to offer me a cookie and a cup of Armenian tea. And I knew then that I was on to something, just being there to listen to him, to actually take a book of historical literature and to read to him and to see him smile when he heard certain words in the book that I was reading. It took a lot of time. And I mean, those trips took like 2 to 3 hours once a week, every Friday for 2 years.
So is what you just described, okay, as someone who is teaching and writing about grant writing, and I want to get to our big question of the call, but it's not very, I have to say that it's not very often that I talk to somebody who would describe themselves as a grant professional who can describe an interaction like you just did. Would that be something that we have somehow or another in grant writing lost? Or is that out there? Because what you just described is the same engagement that I, someone who comes primarily from major gift work, I could describe that narrative. But I think it's extraordinary that you can too.
Do you know why I could do that with so much patience and empathy and build a friendship first? Money wasn't even talked about until 18 months into our relationship. Because I took my training, and I don't think they exist anymore, but it was the Endowment Development Institute. And they had the training in Florida. It was for 5 days. It was run by a group of sisters from a Catholic sect.
Yeah.
And they focused on relationship building and holding hands and kindness and making eye contact and not rushing the ask, but truly becoming a friend and then not dropping that friendship after you receive the check.
So can we get that back? Can grant makers get that, but can grant writers get that back?
I think today, because even foundation program offices are inundated with multiple calls and unsolicited proposals and things submitted the wrong way that they have to kindly call and say, this is our process. I don't think that relationship can come back in the same way that it came back then, because I see a lot of development officers on performance-based contracts.
Yeah.
And if you're on a performance-based contract and it is reviewed critically, at a minimum annually, and if you haven't brought X amount of dollars into the door, you either lose some incentives or you're told that you have 30 days to leave and secure another job if you plan to work in the industry. I think that it's not like that today. We don't have that leisure of courting somebody for 18 months before we talk about being the primary contributor to an outdoor nature education center and putting their name on it. Naming rights weren't even a term that I knew back then. I just know that he wanted his name remembered after he died. And he died shortly after giving the gift.
Okay, so I asked you before we got started if you had a big idea, bold opinion. You said you had a big, bold statement. So what's the what is that big assertion or whatever that we can talk about for a few moments?
We can talk about having a kinder world of funding development where we do get to know individuals that we intend to go to and ask for money. As a grant writer and a consultant especially, I don't have that relationship with funders because I want my clients to build those relationships. Consultants are here today, gone tomorrow. However, the executive director, the board president, the board treasurer, they're there for an interim or sometimes long time frame. And if they can build that relationship and keep that relationship after the gift, then I think truly they have an advocate for their organization in the community. Whether they ever intend to go back to that individual for another major donation or not, they have a friend forever doing goodwill on their behalf by telling people, this is a great organization. I got to know the people. I got to go on a tour. I got to have lunch with the program staff. I got to work a day with the volunteers, and it really made me feel like a part of this organization's family. That's why I gave. No letter is going to generate that kind of check. No phone call, cold, is going to generate that kind of a feeling of being a part of something, belonging to something.
So are you of the opinion, so one of the critiques that I made, so you and I figured out that we were both at the New Orleans, at the AFP conference in New Orleans, and that's where I was giving away hundreds of copies of my new book at the time. One of the critiques that I've made, and it sounds like you would possibly make the same critique, is that fundraisers, whether they be in a grant writing role or major gifts role or something, have sort of either lost their heart or they haven't really found it. And I think about the Tin Man in the Wizard of Oz. Is that kind of where we're at? Is we've sort of lost our heart, and consequently, we don't know how to. When I think of a grant writer, I think of a grant writer sitting behind a desk on a Word document, you know, typing out proposals or something and never having any kind of meaningful conversation. But I don't get a sense from you that that's anything close to what you're suggesting that they need to be doing.
No, they need to have meaningful conversations
right.
with their clients.
Right.
They need to attend any kind of a forum where funders will be gathered so that they have an opportunity to observe the culture, the priorities that are being discussed in small circles around the room during the networking time frame. They need to make sure they hand out their cards, not so much to get a new client, but to just connect with people and to talk to them about what is your opinion of the local fundraising climate. What do you see that are red flags with nonprofits that are coming to you asking for support? What do you see as a red flag because you're advertising yourself as a philanthropist? What do you hate the most before you give the gift, when you give the gift, and after you give the gift? So I've been asking those kinds of questions, and the responses are phenomenal.
Is that the people we hire for grant writing roles, though?
We don't hire them, but a grant writer has to be a visionary, not just someone who can type and research grants and spit out these phenomenal words and get awards in. You have to be a visionary because nonprofits like to do the same thing over and over and over. They don't want to change programs because staff will become more disgruntled than they are, already working more hours than they're paid for to keep their programs up and functional and help with the evaluation data collection. So with that, everybody is reporting to work on Monday morning already in burnout before they get there. It's hard to focus on kindness and in-depth relationships, but I look at what are the funders talking about. Where do I see red flags in development offices and with organizations that are just entering the grant-seeking arena for the first time, I don't just do a funding search and then say to my client, okay, these are the grants that I need to write, and this is the fee. It is like, you need to get out and build a relationship, and you need to take a board member with you, and I'm going to train you on the dialogue. We're going to have role play calls that I record and send you the recording so you can see where you fall off the cliff in your conversations for my questions, which simulate questions from a program officer or a potential individual donor. And then when I feel like you're ready, I'm going to say, okay, now you can schedule 3 meetings this month. These are the 3 priority individuals or funders that I think you should reach out to. And it is a very long relationship building process, and they're not used to that. They come to me and they say, we need a grant. We need a grant now. And I stop that conversation right away.
Okay. So this is the most refreshing conversation. I have one other friend. You probably know her. She's in the Midwest in Cincinnati, and she does grant writing. She and I have had this conversation. She's a big fan of your stuff. But this is probably one of the more refreshing conversations that I've had in a while, probably ever, with a grant writer, because I see the grant profession as having become so mechanical and so much about technique. And yet everything I'm hearing from you reminds me of a conversation I had 20 years ago when I first started in fundraising. I was talking to a foundation officer at a university in upstate New York who told me that he that's all he did. He worked with private foundations. He said, Jason, I do not write a proposal until I meet with them in person and have a handshake agreement, on what it is that proposal is going to say. And I have repeated that, what I just repeated to you, I have repeated that over and over and over again, to people who inquire about how I suggest they should approach grants. And yet I don't think that the people that are teaching grant writing out there, I don't think that's what they're hearing.
I can't speak for other trainers.
Yeah.
Or even the courses that I have online, because they were guided by corporations who had,
sure,
who had different ideas than I did. So
yep,
if I wanted,
yep,
to teach, I had to do it.
Yep.
But the bottom line is, I really learned about the value of relationship building, you know, again, with that incident of plan giving or endowment development. And I had no idea what a fundraiser was. I just knew I was a project specialist assigned to write grants, and that because no one else at our district, from the Board of Education to the superintendent to the director of Grants and Development Office, my boss, no one wanted to go meet with this gentleman because they said his conversations never stopped. They could never get away. And I thought about what they said, and it's like, he's older. He's an elder. He's from Armenia. He has so much to share about,
yeah,
his life and growing up and being in the old country and, you know, how he got started when he got here. He had nothing. And then he ended up with like 27 grocery store chains. They weren't interested in all of that. They just wanted a check. And they hadn't been very successful in,
yeah,
meeting, you know, taking him to a lunch or anything else to get this because they wanted it like that day. And he wasn't very receptive to me when I first called and got through about why I wanted to come over. And I explained who my grandfather was and how he had worked for this other family in the neighborhood that is quite well known. And we still know them today as one of the largest foundations in the world. But when he found out that I had a connection to the Mott family through my grandfather, and he worked on the estate at Applewood as a handyman, maintenance person, and repaired their cars and kept them in shape decades and decades ago. When he heard that I actually was that person's grandchild and that I knew about another philanthropist in town, he was interested in meeting me, but I had to sell him on the phone that I was someone worth meeting.
Yeah, so where is all this go? So you've been doing this for 4 decades. Again, you've published, you teach, you write. Is it going to, It sounds to me like what you've been sharing with me for the last 10 or 15 minutes, the idea that in some ways you want to redeem what has been lost. But where's it going? Where's it going to go when you sort of hang up your hat and you say you're done with your career? Where will it be? And where will it be after you're no longer there to sort of advocate for this?
Okay. So let me make this little declaration. I'm working till my last breath.
Right, that's fine.
I'm good with that. I don't have a choice. I'm happy.
Yes. I'm not trying to push you out. I'm probably trying to hold on, but
I want to work now. All these years, I've always worked with mid to large size nonprofits. I've taken on a few that were just getting started, and I helped them get started up, you know, money and get off, and do a good job. They're still in existence or in business, but I had a turn of heart last year. Something happened in November, and I realized it was going to change the way I lived and that I would need to downsize. I would need to, you know, tuck in the expenses or get rid of them and really focus on where is my role? What am I supposed to do? What am I being called to do? And what is my ministry in this profession? And everything came back to me, and it is work with the organizations that you've typically avoided because they require so much handholding. Work with the nonprofits that can't afford your regular fees and figure it out so that you still have a roof over your head, food in the refrigerator, but that you are truly leaving a legacy of someone who cared.
So do you feel, okay, so what I just heard without you using, so I love the word messiness, and I feel like the nonprofit sector is where I feel like the nonprofit sector, if we're supposed to be around for anything, it's to help address the messiness in our world.
And, absolutely.
Yeah. And I don't think that fundraising as a profession, and I think grant writing, you know, very specifically, is certainly one of those examples where we have done everything in our, you know, everything possible to get away from the messiness. And what you just described is, you said, look, I'm going to spend the rest of my time on this earth. I'm going to spend every last breath that I have getting into the messiness with the organizations that otherwise I may have been unable to serve for the last, you know, for the last four decades.
Exactly. And that messiness has a lot to do with the organizational capacity and the lack of board member engagement, the lack of board training, the lack of a strategic plan that is actually a working, active strategic plan and not a static document that gets pulled out once a year for the annual meeting. I am really focusing on all the things that cause red flags with funders before we even go there and ask for money with a grant application.
Yeah. She's one of your peers, and she's in the grant, she's not in the grant writing space. She's in the capital campaign space. And I recently saw an article. She does campaign consulting primarily in the New York area. And I was reading an article of hers that was very honest and somewhat vulnerable in what she feels like her three decades of experience have been. It sounds to me like if you were writing right now, you might have some of that. There was almost regret in there. Am I hearing regret?
No, you're not hearing regret because okay. You know, in the beginning, when you start your business, you become self-employed.
Yeah.
You follow the money. Follow the money.
Right.
You go with those organizations that can afford to work with you.
Yes.
And I've done that. But three times in the last 43 years, following the money brought me to a cliff that I almost fell off of. Okay. And you would have thought that I would have learned the first two times.
Right.
about not following the money, but I didn't, and I was hard-headed, and I didn't listen to the universe, and I didn't listen to myself, but this third time of falling off the cliff happened shortly before Thanksgiving, and I just didn't know what to do. I threw my hands up in the air and I said, okay, January is the ground zero for me. I need to figure out where I am, what I'm supposed to be doing, and why I'm supposed to be doing it. And I keep saying that I want peace and joy, but I don't have that now. I'm serious. I want to know what peace and joy feels like. So just pour into me and tell me what to do to experience peace, joy, and still pay the bills. And everything just became pretty clear about 3 weeks after saying that out loud. I believe you say things out loud, they begin to manifest.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons I like this format, is because it's not one of the things I do with this format, as you know, is we didn't script it. We just sort of agreed to a general idea, and I didn't know what you were going to say when we got started. But you know, when you talk about things being manifest in our words, I think sometimes we're so careful. It's that notion of avoiding the messiness. And I think that's what, when I think about grant writing, I think about the grants that I've been a part of getting written. I don't think that they reveal some of the messiness. Do you think, okay, so I get the messiness and what you want to do. Do you think funders out there, before I let you go, do you think funders are getting more tolerant of that messiness, more receptive to hearing and being okay with the messiness and not feeling like that proposal has to be absolutely perfect?
No, I think funders are in tune to the fact that there's a lot of messiness there. Uh-huh. Which is why they want to have these pre-conversations before you even write a letter of inquiry, yeah, or submit an online proposal. I think funders are asking serious questions up front before they even build a relationship. The minute they start talking to an ED or a board president, how many people on the board? How engaged are they? Do you have a reserve? What is your annual operating budget? They're sort of pre-qualifying who it is they even want to receive a one- or two-page letter from. And I think that's great. And we have a funder here locally in the Valley that if you don't go through their fellowship program, and they're a huge foundation, if you don't go through their fellowship, if you're not invited, I should say, to go through their fellowship program, your chances of getting a grant are pretty much between 0 and 2%. They want to train these people that represent these nonprofit foundations exactly how to run the organization correctly so that they can be a good steward of the grant they receive.
Are they okay, so that process that they're that pre-qualification process, are they trying to avoid the messy organizations, or are they just trying to get a more honest assessment of who it is they're partnering with?
They are trying to lift up and build the capacity of the executive directors in the messy organizations.
Okay, so they're not running. They're not scared of the messiness.
No, they're not afraid of the messiness. They're digging in, and they've created a program to help them understand the importance of capacity building.
Yeah, okay.
In all areas.
Yeah. Okay. So. And I think that's part of what – I think that's some of the disservice that we do to fund – I think that's some of the disservice that we quote-unquote experts and gurus – I would definitely critique sort of our advising sort of cohorts, colleagues for doing, is that we have convinced ourselves we've convinced the organizations that by not looking like you've got it all together, you're going to get yourself in trouble. When in fact, when you show your messiness, you might even build a more stronger partnership and a better relationship.
Absolutely. I used to have a long-term client, and they were just write this, apply for this. What's the program design? Whatever you want. And it would be like, seriously? That's how I learned how to design programs that were best practice models that had national evaluations done on them and impact studies. So when I would send back the draft of the grant application and they would say, why did you build in all of these measurements that we have to meet? Why did you build in such a rigorous evaluation by a third party? And it's because I'm trying to keep you legitimate. That's why.
Yeah, right. I think the thing that Those of us who land in the nonprofit sector, a lot of us have not worked in the private sector. And I think we just don't understand how messiness they know their business is. And they may be able to, they get their stuff together and they come across as if they know what they're doing. And the walls are painted well and the conference room looks great. But I think sometimes those people on the receiving side, those of us on the receiving side are somewhat naive to how aware the funder really is. And if we would just sort of open up.
Tell the truth, open the skeletons in the closet.
Yeah.
And understand that human beings have hearts that can feel where you are, what you've been through, how badly you need a funding infusion, and they're willing to step up and help. I say hats off to the world of grant makers who suddenly have had to become much more engaged and involved in helping build up smaller nonprofits.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Browning, I have had you for a little bit more than a half hour now, and we lose our listeners after keeping them this long. So if anybody wants to reach out to you, and I would encourage, and before we completely let you go, I want to make sure that you reference how people can find your stuff, your website, your books. Tell us some of that before I let you go.
Okay, my website is BevBrowning, BROWNING.com. You'll find a link on there for a ton of resource books on Amazon, including my book, which is in the sixth edition as of 2016, Grant Writing for Dummies. Don't be scared off by the title. It's definitely an encyclopedia of how to do it and how to do it right. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn. I am not on any other social media other than LinkedIn, and just, invite me to connect with you, and I will do that gladly. I have a group on LinkedIn called Dr. Bev Browning's Group. It's former grant writing students as well as current grant writers, and we all share resources with each other. So that's how to connect with me. I do teach online classes at edtogo.com. Three of them, you'll see them if you just log in and look at the catalog. But it's pretty easy to reach me. Just Google my name. My number is available, worldwide. And I just look forward to hearing from your listeners if they have questions, if they want to follow up with the conversation, or if they have ideas how you and I, Jason, might do another podcast maybe 6-7 months from now, to follow up on where this is going once we see how the election impacts the world of philanthropy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think between that with the election and the foreseeable, I think we're all talking about the idea of we've had a really good run in the stock market, so the possibility of a looming recession, I think it's going to be an interesting and transition between baby boomers and a lot of that those assets being transitioned, moving around from generation to generation. Bev, you're always welcome to come back. As long as you got a big idea or bold opinion, you're certainly welcome to come back.
Well, thank you. And thank you for your time today. I sincerely appreciate it.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.